This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The 2020 census is almost here, and the National Urban League wants to make sure that everyone gets counted, in particular communities of colour, which historically have been undercounted. Urban League President and CEO Mark Morial says the census is all about money and power. It's how the federal government figures out funding for the food stamp program, the Head Start program, and other initiatives. He says getting a fair count is a challenge, but there are now more ways to participate in the census. Well, Mark Morial is the National Urban League President and CEO. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's good to be in Orlando.
So your focus for this visit is the census. You're really taking a close look at that. Why is it so important to the Urban League?
The census is about money and power. It's about how important programs such as the food stamp program, the Head Start program, which serves children, community development programs, how the federal government distributes dollars. It's based on numbers and data that come from the census. So to be fully treated fairly, you've got to be fully counted, completely counted. And that's why we're talking about the census. Also, historically, our constituency, African Americans and other communities of color, have been undercounted in the census. So we're making a concerted effort that there is no undercount in 2020. We want to do our part, both in holding the Census Bureau accountable to do everything it's legally and statutorily responsible for doing, as well as on our side, pushing to motivate our community to participate.
Have you sort of had a look back at what the Urban League was doing for previous censuses? Like, was the league always involved?
Involved, according to the information we have, all the way back to the 1970s, when my illustrious and esteemed predecessor, the late Whitney Young, was intimately involved. In fact, he used the exact same theme, Make Black Count, that we're using in 2020. So we've historically been involved because our constituents deserve a fair shake of federal dollars. Our constituents deserve a fair shake of congressional seats and councilmanic seats and state legislative seats. And it's all determined based on the count in the census.
Talk to me more, if you could, about why it is that you feel like communities of color, whether African American or Latino, stand more to lose from the census, or there's more likelihood of an undercount. Like, why is that?
I mean, I think that historically, the undercount has stemmed from lack of an aggressive effort by the Census Bureau to ensure that everyone was counted, a lack of information, and fear sometimes that people have in participating in a government-driven process. So that's meant that there's been a historic undercount of people of color and of people who are poor. We have an opportunity this year to reverse that. And we can reverse it because there are now four ways to participate in the census, in addition to the traditional paper form that you fill out and the traditional option of a knocker coming to your door, a door knocker coming to ask you about the number of people in your dwelling. You've also now going to have an online option and a telephone option. So we're encouraging people to participate in that. But we know that broadband connectivity and access to a computer is lower in African-American communities. So many communities, many cities and states have opened their libraries, opened their community centers. We have to help each other in the community, help our neighbors, help our family members, help everyone ensure that they're counted. If you don't know, ask. If you don't know, go to makeblackcount.org, go to the Census Bureau's website, go search for the information that you need.
Thinking about the level of trust there is in government right now, how would you say that compares to 10 years ago or even like four or five years ago?
That today we're in the 21st century, so we're in the age of cyber. We're in the age of Russian interference. We're in the age of post 9/11. We're in a different era than we were in 20 years ago or 30 years ago. That notwithstanding, I want to believe that with the right push, the right motivation, and the right messages, we can get a complete count because of the multiple ways that people can participate. And the key is for the Census Bureau to make sure it's hiring enough people and putting enough dollars in its advertising to ensure that people who may not participate online actually get their door knocked.
And is that happening right now?
I think that the Census Bureau, many inside the Census Bureau are trying their best, but I'm going to say that there's still questions, but notwithstanding the questions, we don't want people to be deterred from participating. When you receive that letter on March 12th or thereabouts, go fill that form out. Mm-hmm. Include all your children. Take this process seriously.
Now, of course, as you well know, there's been a lot of wrangling over census questions, in particular over the question of citizenship. And, of course, that question won't be included in the census after civil rights groups argue that it shouldn't be there. But is there still some lingering doubts for folks?
Let's make it clear and crystal clear. The citizenship question is not on the census form. So people need to just say it's not on the census form, not debate the issue any longer, but to focus on the fact that it's not there. We need to tell people it's not there. So any concerns related to that are not present in this particular census.
But is that a question that you get from folks you talk to? Like, is there still some sort of lingering concern about that?
It's because people in the political space have continued to talk about it as though it's an unresolved issue. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to focus on the fact that it has been resolved for this census.
Aside from that, I mean, what other challenges are there to making the census a success? You've talked about the multiple ways that you can fill the census out. There is, of course, the kind of trust element that you talked about as well. There's also, you know, connectivity, which you referenced as well. Even just welcoming somebody who's knocking on your door, that can be a moment of hesitation for some folks, right?
People understand why the census matters for them and why it matters for them, because it affects your political representation. It affects your livelihood in terms of support for federal programs that benefit you and your community. That's what it's about. We think if people understand what it's about, then they'll understand why we have to participate. We're going to be doing everything in our power. We have a major town hall that your listeners can participate in by going to makeblackcount.org on March 10th to share information on the census with people. But we're going to continue to do that work.
Do you feel like it's a challenge to get the message out about the census and among everything else that's happening? I mean, there is so much noise about politics, about coronavirus. How do you make yourself heard?
You just have to repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and be consistent. The key is not to be deterred. The census is not going to be delayed. The census will happen. The census is a fact of life. So I'm not worried about the competition. I'm just worried about whether or not the Census Bureau is going to spend the resources and just continue to pound those messages all the way to the end.
Because it's getting pretty close, isn't it?
March 12th is when the first letters will go out. And they've already done some census counting in Alaska, in the northern tier of the United States.
Now, in some messaging from the Urban League, you point out that Orange County, in fact, had one of the worst rates of undercounting as far as the census previously. So does this area of the country, is this a problem area, do you think?
I think this area has a lot to gain and a lot to lose. And I think what happened in this area of the country is that the undercount was significant and it cost. I heard a figure just at noon today that the existence of the undercount means that 7,000 children can't participate in early childhood education. That's tragic. 7,000 children, 7,000 families. Not because they're not able, not because the parents don't want them to, but because the governmental system is not adequately funded.
And it only comes around every 10 years, so you really have to get it right.
Yes. The census that's why they call it the decennial census. You don't get it right, you're stuck with the results.
I want to pivot, if I could, Mark Morial, and talk about some of the issues that the Urban League has been championing over the years. One of the things that you've been working on is campaigning for unanimous juries, for example. Where's that whole debate at?
Well, I think there's one state left, Oregon, that does not require a unanimous jury. And the voters of Louisiana voted to eliminate the 10-person conviction. So you could get convicted in Louisiana with just 10 out of 12. And Louisiana changed that to now require unanimous juries. So Oregon's still out there. This is a relic. It's got racial dimensions to it. The idea that blacks on the jury should not be able to stop a conviction. if there are one or two of them on a jury.
Are you seeing some results from that law change already?
I think the result is that it generates stronger confidence in the system. Anything that generates stronger confidence in the system is good.
Is law and order, sort of justice and those kind of reforms, is that a really key focus of the Urban League?
Justice issues are always and will always be a focus of the Urban League. But our main calling card is economic empowerment, job training, workforce development, helping people get jobs, breaking down the structures for economic inclusion. But justice is always on the agenda.
I want to ask you about the presidential primary on the Democratic side. You had several candidates attend the National Urban League's annual conference last year, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Bill de Blasio, former Vice President Biden, but there aren't too many people from that list who are still left in the race now. What issues did you want them to talk about, and do you feel like the candidates left in the race at this point are addressing the issues that are important to the Urban League?
I honestly think that in this cycle, and I'm looking at this from the perspective of someone who's been involved in politics and presidential politics for a long time, I think there has been a much greater effort in this cycle by many of the candidates to address issues of concern to the African-American community. You've heard the issue of equity on the stage. You've heard the issue of justice on the stage. You've heard candidates embrace reparations. You've heard these candidates talk about African-American entrepreneurship and African-American jobs and closing the racial wealth gap. That conversation alone would not have happened 10 or 20 years ago. And so to that extent, let me tell you, it's like anything. It's the proof is always in the pudding, meaning at the end of the day, if one of them wins, will they deliver on what they promised?
We had a pretty diverse spread of candidates in terms of background. At the start of the race, a very crowded field too, but that's really kind of thinned out. Are you a bit disappointed that it's not so diverse now?
I'm disappointed that Senator Booker and Senator Harris didn't make it to the first round of primaries. And I think the Democratic National Committee's rules of requiring a certain number of contributors was an obtuse rule because they changed the rule when Michael Bloomberg got in. He's got one contributor. So I think the only rule that should count on whether you should participate in a debate may be your poll numbers, that you have to get be viable politically. But how many contributors you have, whether you self-finance, you have big contributors, you have small contributors, should not be a criteria as to whether you're going to participate in a debate. So I think that the system of how you elect the president, how the Democrats manage their system has to change. I also think that there's got to be, should be changes in the sequencing of primaries. I don't see why Iowa and New Hampshire have to be first and have outsized influence. Why couldn't Florida be first? It's a much more diverse state. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't you have a collection of states? Why couldn't you rotate the number of states, have big and small states that host the first primaries? This old tradition that people think is ancient, really started in the 1970s. It's time, I think, to just blow it up and start over.
How hard would you think it would be to do that, though?
I think with leadership, I think that the Democratic National Committee has changed its rules over the years to accommodate other issues. I think now we see there was a debacle in Iowa. So for the number of people that participated in the Iowa caucuses, some $70 million was spent on television advertising. And internet advertising. Why?
And you look at the amount of money that the likes of a candidate like Tom Steyer spent in South Carolina. Didn't do him any good.
Didn't do him any good. And so what that says is that money, while important, is the only factor. I certainly, you know, wish that Senator Booker and Senator Harris had stayed in, and Mayor Castro.
How important do you think, or how big a factor is the African-American vote going to be in 2020?
Super important. The African-American vote is critical in swing states. So in Wisconsin, the vote in Milwaukee. In Michigan, the vote in Detroit. In Ohio, the vote in Cleveland, Akron, Columbus, and Cincinnati is critical to how those states go. So it's not about just the vote, it's also whether that vote turns out. Register and be educated on the candidates, their pros and cons, and to get out to vote. Mm-hmm. It's one of our biggest priorities this year.
Well, Mark Morial, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Mark Morial is the president and CEO of the National Urban League. Still to come on Intersection, the struggle against homelessness in Osceola County.
And so if we don't come up with some strategies to get families out of those hotels, we're just going to see generational poverty continue to exist in our communities. And so we just want to break that cycle.
A conversation with the CEO of the Community Hope Center, Reverend Mary Lee Downey, who was just named Central Floridian of the Year by the Orlando Sentinel. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Well, Reverend Mary Lee Downey is the Orlando Sentinel Central Floridian of the Year. Let's just hear a little bit of what the Sentinel wrote about Downey. When the indie film The Florida Project opened in 2017, it revealed to audiences the kind of life that tourism workers live in Kissimmee hotels, the only shelter some can afford. The movie was nothing new to the Reverend Mary Lee Downey, who founded the Community Hope Centre in 2013. The charity helps low-income families get by and find help, with a focus on the area's homeless and hotel populations. The region's housing crisis may be getting more attention these days, but Downey has been in the trenches for a long time. Well, Reverend Mary Lee Downey, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the award. What does this mean to you in terms of recognition for the work that you've been doing?
I think mostly it's just very humbling to know that we are being recognized. And I have a phenomenal team of people that work alongside me at the Community Hope Center who have been in those trenches with me, and so I'm just very excited that the community and that the Orlando Sentinel saw affordable housing and sees homelessness and the lack of housing available for those who are working poor as a priority, and that they would also come alongside and support our work and give me this honor. It's really overwhelming and still quite shocking. It was just a few days ago. So
now, the Sentinel did point out that you've been working on this for quite some time. You got the Hope Center up and running in 2013. You've helped thousands of people since. What kind of impact have you seen from the work of the Hope Center in Osceola County?
Yeah, we are often very surprised at how the Hope Center has grown and the reach that we've had with the people that we served. When we originally started the Hope Center, we really thought we would be a smaller nonprofit, that we would just be addressing some relationship-based advocacy and case management for the people that were living in hotels and motels along the corridor. After our first year, we simply realized that the need was much greater than anyone actually anticipated, and we have watched our community continue to struggle through many different waves of people living in hotels and motels, and then also folks living chronically homeless and in their cars. And we've seen many different reasons behind that. We've looked at recession. We've looked at people coming from Hurricane Maria. There have been multiple reasons why people have been stuck in this kind of long-term, unfit for habitation housing environment. And so the Hope Center has really been working steadily to help identify the barriers that those people come across and help them overcome those barriers. And so that's anywhere from our iDignity Osceola program, helping people get their IDs back, to our partnerships with 68 other nonprofits in the Central Florida region to do strong referrals and outreach together, to helping people get into housing. And so one of the key components that we really have been working on is helping families move from the hotels, from that long-term housing option, to something that is more sustainable for their family, that is more dignified for their family. And so last year alone, we helped about 59 families do that. In the past, we've overall maybe 300 to 400 families and households have gone through a full housing option. Most of the reason why that number is not more is that the housing stock in our community is non-existent.
Yeah, and that's something you're seeing not just in Osceola County, you're also seeing it in Orange County, Seminole County, basically all across Florida, right? I mean, there just aren't enough houses that are affordable for people.
All across the United States. I mean, it definitely is not something that's just an Osceola County problem. And it definitely is an issue that we have to figure out how to come up against very quickly, or we're going to see just more and more of this happening.
How would you say the housing crisis has changed in Osceola County since you started your work there? Is it getting better? Is it worse? Is it pretty kind of steady?
Yeah, it's absolutely worse. It is absolutely worse. We really have zero housing stock in our community. It's very, very difficult. And we saw this start to tick up in about 2016, actually, is when it started to get really bad. When we first started our work, it was easier to move people out of hotels into apartments or into houses because we still had some leftover stock from people who had bought up houses from the recession. Mm-hmm. And so there had been lots of foreclosed homes that investors had bought up, and those became rentals. And so we were able to put a lot of people into rentals in the, 2014 to 2016 range. But as more and more people have come to Central Florida, more and more people have been in our community, that housing stock quickly has filled up. And now, families have to wait 3 to 6 months. They might have the funding available to move out. They may be financially ready. They might have the employment, but the housing stock is not there.
Mm-hmm. So what does the Hope Center and what do you do as, steering the Hope Center to try and resolve that? Do you find yourself spending more time talking to developers, talking to city and county leaders and state lawmakers to try and get them to do something to build more houses?
Absolutely. So the Community Hope Center was actually donated 5 acres of land a couple of years ago. And so we have stepped into the development side of things ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And was that something you were anticipating at the start of this journey?
Absolutely not. I distinctly remember telling my board that we would never be a housing agency. But we also are an agency that recognizes the barriers that the people that we serve are needing to overcome. And if our number one barrier is housing and there is no housing available and we have this opportunity to build, that is something that we absolutely want to do. Mm-hmm. It's also very, very expensive to build. We can understand why rental prices are what they are because building prices are very, very high. Impact fees are very, very high. And so to make the pro formas work, to make it financially feasible for developers, the rents match pretty much what is happening there. Mm-hmm. We have the opportunity as a nonprofit, though, that we don't need to have, as much profit maybe from the project. We would like to see, obviously, the project not fail. Mm. And so we are still in that space of trying to figure out how do we find a way to affordably build housing that keeps rents low but also doesn't put our organization in debt or is a bad choice. And so we've had conversations with other developers. We have a partner consultant on the project right now, which is Ability Housing, who are helping us discern if we should build this project through philanthropy, if that's actually an option, or if we need to go a tax credit route.
Hmm. And how far off, realistically, do you think you are breaking ground on a project and seeing it actually get up off the ground?
So we have everything in order that we are a completely shovel-ready project. The only thing that we are missing is the finances.
Mm-hmm. And how many units would you say you would be able to build on that 5 acres?
So the shovel-ready plan that we have right now is a little over 200 units, mm-hmm. give or take, depending on parking.
The thing I notice whenever I've covered stories about these affordable housing projects is they always say, the folks who are developing them always say, there is a very, very long waiting list. Like, people kind of pay close attention to these things, basically from groundbreaking to when they open the front doors. But oftentimes people just can't get into them because of the demand, right? So do you feel like it's a bit of a drop in the bucket in some ways? Or is it just, you can't do nothing, so you might as well do something, even if it's a drop in the bucket?
Right. I mean, we are not building enough housing to address the actual, what I would call, epidemic on our 192 corridor. Absolutely not. We don't have the money to do that. And mm-hmm. so in some ways that can be just very discouraging for us as we kind of step into this area. And if we don't step into this space, if we don't say that we're committed to take this risk and to build some housing, then no one else is going to either. And so what we would hope is that as we step into this space and as we become developers ourselves, that other nonprofits, that other developers would also make this a priority, that our community would make this a priority, because it isn't enough housing. Mm-hmm. It will have a wait list. We have people coming in our doors right now that say, when is it going to be open? And we're, not even close to breaking ground. And so it absolutely is frustrating to think that it will not be enough. And also it's encouraging to know that it will be enough for 200 families who don't have anything right now.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it does make a huge difference, right? And I'm sure there's a ripple effect. Once you get one family into housing, that has kind of a knock-on effect helping other folks as well.
Well, and not just in that way, but also it changes the family dynamic for the future. So in some ways, we are addressing a need now, and we are preventing homelessness for the future. Because I always feared what it would be like to have our first family come through the door who had grown up in the hotel. Mm-hmm. So I started this work officially in 2006. And in 2018, I encountered my first child who was now an adult who had grown up in the hotel and now lived in the hotel. And so if we don't come up with some strategies to get families out of those hotels, we're just going to see generational poverty continue to exist in our communities. And so we just want to break that cycle.
Do you try to steer clear of politics much in the work of your nonprofit? And I'm wondering how difficult it might be to do that when so much of housing is tied into politics, with its debates over regulation around funding affordable housing or protecting the Sadowski Fund, which is Florida's Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Like, what's the line you have to walk there?
Well, I absolutely believe that the Sadowski Fund should be 100% allocated to affordable housing. And I don't believe that's a political issue. That is what the requirements of that fund was meant for. And I really would hope and continue to pray, honestly, that our leaders would also see the Sadowski funds in that way. When we have an affordable housing crisis and we aren't putting those funds towards their proper allocation, we're really doing our community a disservice. So I don't actually see that as a political issue. I see that as maybe even a moral issue. I do believe that housing is healthcare, and I believe that if we had had Medicaid expansion in our community in Florida, if we had not turned those funds down, we could have housed more people who are chronically homeless. Those funds have let other communities do that. So again, I feel like that's not a political issue. I feel like political choices happen, and those policy choices affect the people that we serve. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to do is the hard work of figuring out when policy choices and policies put into place, how we can make sure that we continue to protect people, that those policies may unknowingly, to the people who put them in place, disenfranchise people who are in poverty or people who are in homelessness. I think one really great example of that is actually the Real ID Act that was put into place, where it's, just to simple it down, when everybody's talking about that the airport won't let you fly unless you have a star on your license, right? That's the Real ID Act. That's the idea that when you go into the DMV to get your ID or your license, you have to prove your identity, and you have to do that with three forms of identification. So you have to prove your address, you have to prove your social security, you have to show your birth certificate, and then if you have been a married woman, you also have to show your marriage license. If you're a person who has experienced any kind of poverty, sometimes getting a hold of those documents can be very, very difficult. I think about domestic violence as one of the number one ways that people can relate to and see that when you leave an abuser, you're probably not taking your marriage license with you. Mm-hmm. And then you can't go and you can't prove your identity. You can't get your license. You can't go to work. You can't rent an apartment. You can't even rent a hotel room without proper identification. And so even though from a federal standpoint, that ID Act was put into place maybe for other reasons, for safety reasons, to combat terrorism, it in other ways disenfranchises people. And so we had to come up with some ways to address that. And that is why we have iDignity in Orlando and iDignity Osceola as well.
I want to just come back to the idea you talked about before of when you set out you didn't want to become a public housing authority, right? But I was reading that your mother worked for a public housing authority. So I'm wondering if she kind of talked about her work much when you were growing up. And do you think her career had some influence over the work that you now are doing?
Yeah. So the story that we would tell is that I interned with my mom every single summer from about age 11 to probably 16. Mm-hmm. That actually just means that she was trying to figure out childcare for
right.
all of us.
Yeah.
But I got to quotation mark intern with her. And so I do believe that there is a lot of that just in me. I mean, I got to see a lot. I saw it was, Arkansas. So the type of poverty was different that we were seeing and experiencing. And And I also got the opportunity to understand, you know, HUD regulations and what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. As a sort of 11 through 16-year-old?
Yeah, as a kid.
Wow. Because it's not easy to figure that stuff out, is it?
Yeah, I always used to say that, like, I could do a HUD house inspection with my eyes closed, except they're supposed to be open.
Right.
And but this is the truth of it. My mom has a huge heart for housing. She herself knows what it's like to struggle and did struggle. And so she, one of her issues that she always had when she was working in public housing, which is very different from what we're doing at the Hope Center. I do want to clarify, yeah, we're not looking at being a public housing authority. That's a very different thing in many ways. But one of her frustrations was she always felt like that the people that she was trying to support didn't have proper services and resources and wraparound care around them.
And that's what the Hope Center is.
And that is what the Hope Center
in.
Does. And so she has always been very proud of our work, because we kind of brought in that missing piece that she felt like was always necessary and needed for people to not be stuck, mm-hmm, in public housing. And so we really believe that as we look into building affordable housing, that we are doing so more in along the lines of building neighborhoods, building opportunities for people to build community together, fellowship, to learn and grow along beside each other. 192 has very little opportunities for that right now. People are very transient. They're not living in neighborhoods. The neighborhoods that exist, there's a couple of small little neighborhood pockets of people who've lived there for a long time. And then the other neighborhood-looking places are vacation homes. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you've got the same thing kind of happening. And so one of the things that we're really passionate about is that we would be building housing that would be connected to resources and wraparound care and services, and also friendships and relationships and fellowship, the things that make communities work.
What do you think the next decade looks like for the Hope Center?
So one of the things that we're really passionate about and that we've been working towards is the opportunity to partner with local churches, and primarily with the United Methodist Church, which is where my ordination credentials belong, in this idea that churches are situated in areas of the communities where kind of the whole community has grown up around them. And a lot of them have excess property and they have excess land. And so one of our strategies for the next 10 years is to partner with those local churches to help them utilize their property in a way that could bring more spaces into affordable housing. And so if that's a church that has extra, you know, 10 acres of land in the back of their building that they thought that at one time they were going to put a private school on, but now, you know, they haven't done that. Can we put housing there? Or do they have, you know, two or three parsonage that were built that we get, and this is actually something we're already doing, rent those spaces out to people in their community who need housing instead of just using them to store file boxes. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely have this strategy that we want to see that it doesn't end with this property that we're wanting to build, which is an old church property that we are building on. So it doesn't end with just one housing development, that it continues on. You know, one of the things that I said in my speech was that we are going to do it again and again and again, because we don't want to be a drop in the bucket. And we do believe that this is the solution. And we believe that churches actually have a really, really unique opportunity to meet the needs of their community in this way.
Reverend Mary Lee Downey is the founder and CEO of the Hope Center in Osceola County. She's also this year's Orlando Sentinel Central Floridian of the Year. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Still to come, Boeing hit a snag with the test flight of its Starliner spacecraft. So what does that mean for the future of human spaceflight from the US?
You know, perhaps we weren't as rigorous with Boeing because they have been involved in almost in every human spaceflight program that we've had. And SpaceX came up during this new technology age, and perhaps they were better prepared.
A conversation with space reporters Chibali Karazana and Brendan Byrne when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Boeing Starliner test flight didn't go as planned. The uncrewed test flight last December never made it to the International Space Station for a rendezvous. So what went wrong? The company says a computer software issue caused the problem. Now they're working to fix it. But where does that leave NASA, which is relying on Boeing and SpaceX to develop the spacecraft to ferry astronauts to the space station so the agency doesn't have to rely on Russian Soyuz capsules to do the job? Space reporters Brendan Byrne and Jabeli Karazana explain there's more at stake than just national pride in being able to once more launch US astronauts from US soil. We're joined by Jabeli Karazana. She's a space and business reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Jabeli, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Brendan Byrne, 90.7 space reporter. Brendan, thank you as well.
Always happy to be here.
All right, so let's start with the review that Boeing has been doing of its human spaceflight system. Brendan, just get us caught up to speed. What's going on there?
So the uncrewed mission of Boeing Starliner was cut short. Basically, what happened was a software glitch on the spacecraft put the wrong time into all of the computer software. So basically, the hardware uses this thing called a mission elapse timer, starts counting, and every single event that happens is based on this timeline. Well, they started at the wrong time, which messed up everything.
Right. So they launched it okay, and then this spacecraft were just kind of zooming around. They're like, hang on a minute, it's not going to end up where it's supposed to be, right, Shirley?
Yeah, exactly. It didn't, the thrusters didn't go off at the right time. So essentially, the spacecraft ends up being in the wrong orbit, and it starts wasting a lot of fuel, and that essentially means it cannot dock with the International Space Station. So that's the first thing that goes wrong. The mission is already not going in the direction it was supposed to go. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they realize it was a coding error, and they start hunting for other coding errors through the mission, and they find out that the service module, at the point that it's supposed to separate from the crew capsule, there's a mistake there as well, which could have led the two spacecraft to collide with each other. And that was a big concern for the team.
Is that sort of worst case scenario?
I think so.
That would have been pretty bad. So basically the Starliner has the capsule that the humans are in, and then this chunk of hardware on the back of it called the service module. This is where the batteries are, a lot of the fuel. And right before it goes to make reentry, it separates from it. But as Jabeli was saying, they discovered that there was a glitch that, had they not caught this glitch, there could have been the possibility of the service module bumping into the heat shield. And when you have spacecraft that are zooming through on orbit on, you know, thousands of miles per hour, little bumps like that could be, you know, disastrous in space. So luckily they were able to catch this, but it just goes to show you all of the software issues that the Starliner was dealing with on this trip.
There's a lot of stuff up there too, isn't there? I mean, it could have bumped into other things that are just flying around.
There is. Space is big. So the chances of it hitting like a satellite or something like that are slim to none. Really the issue is that it could have knocked the heat shield, which could have then cracked the heat shield or you know, hurt it in some way that it wouldn't be able to protect the capsule on its reentry.
You don't want to crash in space.
You don't want to crash in space.
Right. So how did you figure out, Jabeli, what went wrong? What kind of investigation did you make, and what led you to the conclusions you found?
Well, we got a lot of information back from Boeing pretty quickly. But, you know, it is a very detailed investigation. There's a lot going on. So what we did was we reached out to the members of NASA's Safety Advisory Panel, who are briefed by NASA on the ongoing investigation. So we knew they had additional details. And the main thing that we found was they were quite surprised by the fact that Boeing had not performed this end-to-end integrated test with the Atlas V rocket. Mm-hmm. So sort of taking the rocket and the spacecraft, sort of communicating with each other from the beginning of the mission all the way through the end of the mission, through every single maneuver, they had not done that. And so that's what we learned. And they said, you know, we're very surprised by that, because we think, had they done that, they would have been able to catch some of the issues that later cropped up during the flight.
I think what was interesting about, we got a briefing from John Mulholland last week. He's the vice president of the Starliner and the project program manager. And while he talked about these kind of issues in testing, we never really got an answer as to why there wasn't this end-to-end testing, right? It was, well, we're not cutting corners, we're not saving, you know, this isn't a cost-saving thing, but it just didn't happen. It will happen going forward, but we don't know why it didn't happen in the first place. And there's just so many pieces of legacy hardware, new hardware and software on the Starliner, that all of these things need to come together, and some of them didn't play nice with each other, basically.
Yeah, I think he just tried to say this, you know, logically for us, it made sense to test it in chunks So essentially, you know, the up to launch, up to the point when the spacecraft and the rocket separate, it made sense to test those two pieces of hardware and software together. But had they extended that, they would have caught the timing issue,
right,
for example. And so,
and it's just extending it by a minute or two, right? It wasn't even very long.
Yeah, it wasn't long, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So essentially what they're saying now is we're going to still do this extensive testing that we do in pieces, but we're also going to just run it through the entire thing. That's like a 25-hour plus experience. And so they're going to try to do that from now on to see if they can find these issues that they didn't find the first time.
And Boeing isn't exactly a newcomer, right? I mean, they've been doing this for quite some time. It's not a SpaceX, so,
yeah, so that's
they're
one of
in the surprise, I suppose.
That's one of the interesting things we heard from the panel as well. They were saying, you know, perhaps we weren't as rigorous with Boeing because they have been involved in almost in every human spaceflight program that we've had. And SpaceX came up during this new technology age, and perhaps they were better prepared for software issues and that sort of testing. So it's really interesting how we've had to kind of reevaluate the position each contractor has in the program, and you know, there was this thought that perhaps Boeing, although they were the legacy contractor, you know, they weren't as prepared.
And a lot of, we found out a lot of the hardware and software on the Starliner comes from the X-37B program, which is Boeing's secret space plane that they fly the mini shuttle that they fly for the Air Force, which as far as we know, has had a very successful career in space.
Well, we don't know that much.
We don't know that much, but we know it goes up and it comes down. So,
what's it doing up there, though?
No clue. No clue. But you know, that hardware has been flight proven. It's flown before, which is kind of what makes this story a little more interesting. Is that all these different pieces just didn't play well together?
Right. All right. How does it affect the schedule? What happens next?
Well, we're supposed to get an update from NASA and Boeing this week about this joint review that Boeing asked for to work with NASA to find out any more of these software issues. There's something like, what, a million lines of code that they've gone through. They're running every if-then statement and logic stem in the software code to see where everything goes, what would happen if this happens. So it's this very rigorous testing, and we're supposed to get an update.
Mm-hmm. Who's doing this coding?
Who is doing the coding? I don't
know. Boeing does the coding, I believe, and NASA certifies it.
Yeah.
And so we don't know. Basically, we asked them this last week, and they said, we don't know if we're going to have to do another test without crew before we go on to our crewed mission. And that's kind of what we're still waiting to hear back from, is whether they're going to do that. But ultimately, that puts the entire timeline in question. You know, this program's already delayed by a few years.
Yeah, we still don't know if NASA is going to require Boeing to do another uncrewed mission.
Right.
That's kind of been the million-dollar question. Well, it's $412 million question. as Boeing has taken out some $400 million in line of credit against themselves in case they do have to fly this again. But ultimately, we learned that NASA will make that decision. There hasn't really been an indication of whether or not they are going to ask them to do that, but it seems like they would probably want them to do another uncrewed mission like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's my guess as well. Yeah. And speaking to the safety advisory panel, you know, they will respect whatever NASA decides, but it seems like they will have to probably do that uncrewed mission again.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 and 89.5. We're speaking to Chibeli Karazana. She is space and business reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, and 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne, talking about the Boeing test of its flight hardware and software to get astronauts back into space from American soil once more. Brendan, what is the timeline at this point? I mean, how soon realistically are we going to see astronauts strapping into Boeing's capsule and blasting off?
In Boeing's capsule, that's very unclear, and I couldn't even make an educated guess at this point without, you know, knowing what this this joint investigation has done, and if NASA requires them to do another launch. We did find out that United Launch Alliance, which provides the Atlas V for Boeing, does have a ride secured for it this year. So whether it is crewed or uncrewed, they will have a rocket to fly to space. But SpaceX is moving forward, and we're getting closer and closer to them being the ones that are going to be launching crew to the station. So Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley are training for that mission. Could be as early as this spring. Elon Musk said, you know, Q2 of 2020, which is a very close timeline.
It's pretty close.
It's very close. Mm-hmm. The hardware is here. It's gone through its final testing. And the interesting thing with that is that with Boeing with the schedule unclear with Boeing and with only one seat left on a Russian Soyuz capsule up to the space station, Chris Cassidy, who's supposed to fly up there in April, NASA is training Bob Behnken and Doug Curley, who are supposed to fly on the SpaceX DM-2, which was supposed to be an up-and-down, week-long test mission. They are going through training as if they were to stay there for an extended period of time. They're going through spacewalking training, EVA training like that. NASA has not said they're going to extend this mission yet, but they are going through just in case NASA says, well, we only have one seat left. There's not many Soyuz seats available we can buy this year. If we want to maintain a robust presence on the space station with NASA astronauts, we can extend this mission. And Doug and Bob are veteran astronauts. They've been to the station before. They've flown the space shuttle. So this is not new for them, but they are going through the training like that is going to happen.
Hmm. Does it mean we could run out of astronauts on the space station? Are they going to be able to maintain the crew they need to keep it flying?
Yeah, that's the major concern. A NASA audit, I think we saw last year, sort of talked about the schedule pressure and trying to ensure that that doesn't happen. But it is looking like SpaceX is on a good path to fly in the next few months. You know, the safety panel is saying, parachutes continue to be an issue for both providers, and it seems like they're getting through most of that testing and they should be okay with that. SpaceX already had this uncrewed mission in March of last year and it went quite well. No major issues there. It's been some time since that.
Seems a little odd that it's parachutes that are slowing them down. I mean, that does not seem like a very particularly high-tech piece of equipment compared to everything else.
We've all been surprised. Yeah, we've all been surprised by the parachute issue. One of the things they said was they were using technology from Apollo, and it seems like the margins that they had calculated at that time were not quite right.
Does that mean, like, when you open the
Right. So what they're learning now is they might have just gotten lucky during the Apollo program. There is a lot of different sort of complicating issues with the parachutes that they're learning now, and they've been able to figure out and work through a lot of that. But there's still a few tests left to go before they're given the green light.
I talked to a source about parachutes, and they said that literally the textbook that they're using is from like the 1950s, and they're rewriting, these hypersonic parachute technologies as they're developing the parachutes for SpaceX and for Boeing. So it's a fascinating storyline that we didn't think was going to come out, but it's really interesting.
Does NASA have some money in the bank in case it does have to buy some more flights on a Soyuz capsule?
I believe so. I believe it's written into the budget, and they're able to purchase it this year. I think if it extends if they have to purchase another seat in 2021, they'll need Congress to both give them the money and allow them to purchase a product from the Russian government. Mm-hmm. So I want to say that we would be okay for this year if they needed to purchase another one. Now, if there was one available is another question, because the Soyuz capsule is going through its own renovations and they're upgrading it, so they might not have as many seats available to sell because they weren't planning on us needing seats.
But Soyuz is a pretty old machine, right? I mean, that's basically kind of Cold War technology.
It's Cold War technology that has gotten plenty of technological
updates
that has been a very reliable spacecraft. There was
one issue last year.
And during ascent, one of the boosters didn't separate when it should have, and the abort system worked flawlessly, got our astronauts home safe. So it's a very robust and it's Cold War technology, and it looks kind of Cold War steampunk, but it has gotten quite a bit of updates over the years. And from all accounts, it's a pretty comfortable ride to space, despite being crammed into it.
So I've heard, Brendan.
I mean, one of the things I'm wondering is NASA has been doing quite a lot of testing, and I'm not sure if the other space agencies have as well, but they've been experimenting with putting astronauts in space for a very long time, right? So could they just say to some of the astronauts up there, sorry, you're not coming down in 6 months, you're going to stay there an entire year because we can't figure out just yet how to get more astronauts up refresh them.
That could be. And what NASA really wants is to avoid the schedule pressure, especially when they have so much pressure on them with this program. It's been almost a decade since they've returned American astronauts to space from U.S. soil. Mm-hmm. And that's really...
There's an element of pride in it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also this issue with, we've had accidents before and we really don't want to start this program off on a bad foot. And that schedule pressure of having folks on the ISS and the Soyuz rocket limitations, you know, that's something that they're looking at, and I think they'll probably try to avoid that as much as they can.
Mm-hmm. There had been kind of conversations between Roscosmos and NASA after that mm-hmm. launch anomaly about, well, what if we can't get astronauts back to the space station? What can we do? And it would still be able to exist. You would still need someone on there. The Russians are the ones that really fly the space station, and then the U.S. kind of runs the science lab. So if there is a limited presence by U.S. astronauts, it would really affect yeah. our research on the International Space Station. The space station would be still be able to fly. It would be difficult to fly it remotely with no one up there, is what the study found, but it could be done. So there is that little bit of pressure, but as Jabeli was saying, they don't want to put that pressure on these private companies, NASA and Boeing, to fill in the blanks. They're kind of looking to see NASA redundancy, a bunch of different ways to make the mission still a success.
Well, Brendan Byrne is 90.7 Space Reporter. Brendan, thanks again.
Anytime.
And Jabeli Karazana is the Space and Business Reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Jabeli, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen back to past episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.